So tonight I'm going to talk about authority. And because there's so many people here who are new, I think the first thing I should say is that I don't understand myself as having any particular authority. I just want to make clear I'm not part of a lineage. I've not gotten some kind of seal of approval from some great master. I'm just a guy who's meditated a lot, and I have been a high school teacher, so I'm comfortable talking to groups, but besides that, I have no real qualifications. But why authority? I was reading some articles about research that had been done on the way human beings think about morality. And apparently, across all moral systems, across the whole world, it's very easy to group moral rules into five basic categories. And it seems that, in some sense, we're almost, you might say, predisposed to think of morality in terms of these five categories. One of them has to do with caring or not harming, you know, being nice, not being bad to people. One of them has to do with fairness. One of them has to do with respecting authority. One of them has to do with loyalty to your group. And one of them has to do with purity. And the thing that's kind of funny is that in the United States, liberals tend to really place tremendous importance on the first two, the caring and the fairness, and we kind of dismiss the other three, whereas conservatives tend to value all five kind of equally. And so it's very easy for liberals to look at the conservatives and say, well, you're not caring, you're not putting as much priority on fairness, and the conservatives say, well, you're not worried about purity, and you're not loyalty to group, and this sort of thing. And we're actually looking at different dimensions of morality. And so this really fascinated me, and so I just wanted to reflect a little more on these dimensions that are not necessarily respected by us liberals here in Berkeley, you know. And so authority, certainly the first authorities we have in life are our parents. And in many ways, it's the relationship that we have with our parents that has some formative impact on how we look at authority. And of course, relationship with parents can be very complicated. I'm just going to sort of break it down into this kind of very simplistic scheme. We could say that there are children, say, you know, certainly toddlers and really up into the age about 9 or 10, that have one kind of relationship, and you might say that it's very much one of idolizing the parent. The parent is great, they love the parent can do no wrong, and I'll call this sort of a child's relationship to the parent. Then there's the teenage years, when the parent is the most ridiculous, foolish person on earth, they offer nothing of value whatsoever, you know, etc., etc. This is the adolescent's view. And then you might say there's the adult view, where we're actually, ideally, able to see our parents, as it were, eye to eye, and realize, you know, this is a fallible human being, they have, you know, my parent, my mother or my father, they have their strengths, they have their weaknesses, they have their blind spots, just like anyone else, and it's more of a seeing them on equal footing kind of thing. I would call that a more mature relationship to authority. And I think I would say that we're funny because we human beings, we're all so complex. And when we get to adult life, there are parts of us that are adult. But then there's parts of us that have been stuck at other ages. There's parts of us that are still at very young ages. There's parts of us that are, you know, at in between ages. And so I think in different situations, any of us could be more childlike with our relationship to authority, or more adolescent, or more mature. And it's funny, because as I reflected on this, it certainly seems that there are some people, and it's debated whether this is a matter of temperament at all, seems that there are some people who are more inclined to obey authority or more inclined to chafe against authority and question it. And really, I think I would say that there's wisdom and insights on both sides. But of course, anyone entrenched on one side is likely to look at the other side and say, well, there's something wrong with that kind of person, you know. And so it's very tricky. And I don't know that it's entirely like this, but I think there's certainly much more of a tendency to question authority on the side of liberals, and much more a tendency to respect authority on the side of conservatives. And it's one of the many kind of divides we have. Ultimately, really what we need, I believe, is to listen to people of very different perspectives and to cooperate with people of very different perspectives. You know, the idea that any one of us could just, you know, I could come up with all the answers all by myself, that's a very dangerous idea. We need dialogue, and including dialogue with people who really vastly disagree with us. And it's a matter of tremendous concern to me that we don't have this kind of dialogue in our nation right now. I will say, well, there's one particular psychology experiment that I want to talk about a little bit. And of course, I know we have a therapist in the room, so you're probably familiar with this. This is the Milgram experiment, and I won't describe it in tremendous detail. So many of you, I'm sure, have studied this if you've ever taken a psych class. But the idea is that the subject would come in and they'd be placed in this situation where they thought they were causing harm to another person. Actually no harm would be done. It was an actor, but they'd be hearing this person scream, and they thought they were doing tremendous harm. And they wanted to, you know, they were obviously feeling uncomfortable with this, but when they asked to stop, there were these very generic kind of statements that the experimenter would say, like, you have to continue, or something like this. And there were just four statements in a row. So the person would say, you know, say they want to stop, and the experimenter would say, you'd have to continue. And if they still object, there would be a second statement, and they still objected, there would be a third statement. And then once they got through the fourth statement, if they still objected, they'd be allowed to stop right there. But the astonishing thing is that most people, there were a few people who objected enough and they stopped the experiment in mid-course, but most of the people stayed all the way to the end. And they got very uncomfortable and they objected a few times, but when they heard, well, you must continue, or the experiment depends on you continuing, or something like this, they just kind of buckled under and kept on doing it, even though they felt they were doing someone else harm. And it's a very disturbing experiment. Of course, Milgram did this in the 1950s, he was trying to understand Nazism. Because, of course, in Nazi Germany, there were a few, you know, wacky nut jobs running the show. But in order for it to run, a lot of rank-and-file citizens had to cooperate. You know, and what makes people cooperate under, you know, under those kinds of circumstances? And it's, I don't know, it certainly calls for reflection. I think it's very naive and easy for me to sit here and say, well, if I was in Nazi Germany, I wouldn't have cooperated, you know. It's very hard to know what it would be like to be in that situation. So one other aspect I wanted to talk about is, what authorities do we recognize? Now, it's interesting, you know, certainly I think we would all agree that, you know, in very specific areas of life, for example, I have mechanics that I trust, and so I regard them as an authority when they say, you know, something needs to be done on my car or something like that. We all have, you know, these, you know, whether doctors or handymen or whatever, but not so much on these individual topics. On the big questions of, what does it mean to be a human being? How should I live my life? How should I behave in the world? what goals should I be pursuing in my life? On these big questions, what is the authority that we follow? And I think the wisdom traditions are very clear that if ego is the authority, we have a problem. You know, if ego says, you know, I am the highest thing that I recognize in my life, I get to make all the decisions, that there's something inherently problematic about that. One way to say what to phrase what the wisdom traditions say is that the sacred is an authority. Now that's a funny thing to say in the sense that we don't necessarily have clear, ongoing, direct access to the sacred. For example, Gandhi talked about an inner voice, and when he got deep in meditation, he would hear this inner voice, and in fact, he fought throughout his Satyagraha campaign. He actually followed the advice of this inner voice on several occasions, when to start his fast, when to stop his fast, all this stuff. And another way to say it might be to say that authority rests not with my ego, but with my wholeness, with my whole self. And I really don't think that they're necessarily, that those two answers are necessarily different. I would say that much as the eye is the organ that apprehends light, our wholeness is the organ that apprehends the sacred. And much as I can, you know, I can conceptually distinguish my eye from the light it sees, in practice, it's all one experience. I experience my eyes by experiencing light. I experience the sacred by experiencing my wholeness. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. So, as usual, I have a quote sheet for tonight. Yeah. And it starts out with quotes from a number of sacred sources. Not surprisingly, Mr. Confucius has a lot to say about authority. So some lines from Confucius. The master said, if you can revive the ancient and use it to understand the modern, you are worthy to be a teacher. This one is fascinating. When Adip Lu heard a precept, his one fear was that he might hear another before he could put the first into practice. And just that idea of the precepts have such compelling authority, you know. The master said, people are too wild when nature dominates culture in them, and too tame when culture dominates nature. But when nature and culture are blended and balanced in them, they are noble-minded. This wonderful one, the master said, I am not born with great wisdom. I love the ancients and diligently seek wisdom among them. Characteristic, tremendous humility. The master said, unless you've been appointed to office, don't fuss and fret over the business of government. In his native village, Confucius was simple and sincere, as if he couldn't speak. At court or the ancestral temple, though always cautious and reverent, he spoke openly and easily. At court, speaking with lower officials, he was forthright. Speaking with higher officials, he was diplomatic. And speaking with the sovereign, he was wary and self-assured. Very, very interesting combinations of qualities there. Duke Shi asked about governing, and the master said, when those nearby are pleased, those far away come and gather around. This whole idea that the authority of a ruler ultimately depends on the benefit that he's bringing his people. Which, in a, you know, which is not too different from this, you know, American idea of the power to govern derives from consent of the governed, this sort of thing. From the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu says, I have three treasures which I hold fast and watch over closely. The first is compassion, the second is frugality, the third is not daring to be first. Because I am compassionate, therefore I can be brave. Because I am frugal, therefore I can be generous. Because I dare not be first, therefore I can be a leader of men. If a man wants to be brave without first being compassionate, generous without first being frugal, or a leader without first wishing to follow, he is only courting death.
Damn.
Yeah. And then this famous one, it's the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount from the Gospel according to Matthew. And when Jesus had finished these sayings, the crowd was astonished, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes and Pharisees. And it's a fascinating thing that you see throughout the Gospels, that Jesus, on the one hand, he is constantly valorizing the lowest of the low and the embracing all the rejects of society. And at the same time, it is as if he's talking with this kind of authority that the self-appointed, you know, religious authorities of his time don't understand and don't appreciate. From Mr. Plato, we have simply the wise have the most authority. From Jean-Jacques Rousseau, no man has any natural authority over his fellow men. And of course, it was his ideas and the ideas of Locke and others that played very heavily into our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. And then juxtaposed with Mr. Rousseau, Robert E. Lee says, obedience to lawful authority is the foundation of manly character. And so this whole idea that we benefit from obeying authority. Of course, it's typical that this would be said by someone who was in the military. This touching one from Tennyson, authority forgets a dying king. That one I just find quite evocative. And the Mr. Gandhi's name is cut off, it's on the other side. Moral authority is never retained by any attempt to hold it. It comes without seeking and is retained without effort. This whole idea of moral authority. And I love this one from Einstein. To punish me for my contempt with authority, fate made me an authority myself. From John the 23rd, authority is mainly a moral power. Therefore, it must first call upon the conscience, that is, upon the duty that each person has to contribute willingly to the common good. He was a rather astonishing person, John the 23rd. He was a reformer of the church. He was the one who took the Mass out of Latin, put it into the vernacular language. He was like this incredible breath of fresh air. It's like the first time the Catholic Church relaxed in 1,000 years when he was Pope. From Robert A. Heinlein, no statement should be believed because it is made by an authority. Vince Lombardi, the great football coach, tells us football is like life. It requires perseverance, self-denial, hard work, sacrifice, dedication, and respect for authority. From Milgram, who did that experiment, Stanley Milgram, the disappearance of a sense of responsibility is the most far-reaching consequence of submission to authority. From the Dalai Lama, the ultimate authority must rest with the individual's own reason and critical analysis. Shakti Gawain tells us, when we consistently suppress and distrust our intuitive knowledge, looking instead for authority, validation, and approval from others, we give our personal power away. From Noam Chomsky, I think it only makes sense to seek out and identify structures of authority, hierarchy, and domination in every aspect of life and to challenge them. Unless a justification for them can be given, they are illegitimate and should be dismantled to increase the scope of human freedom. This, I was intrigued by this one from Germany, Kent. How to win in life. 1. Work hard. 2. Complain less. 3. Listen more. 4. Try, learn, grow. 5. Don't let people tell you it can't be done. 6. Make no excuses. From Chris James, I think we had this quote another time, showing a lack of self-control is in the same vein granting authority to others. Perhaps I need somebody else to control me. That's essentially what we're saying. And from Michael Bassey Johnson, no matter how tiny you look, you can lead huge men if you have what the huge men don't have.